Welcome to the Geological Society podcast. In this episode, we talk to Mike Stevenson, Head of Energy Science at the British Geological Survey, about a project which hopes to reduce carbon emissions in the UK and across the world. First, January's Shell lecturer, James Jackson, explains how his research into structural geology can help communities deal with earthquakes. So could you perhaps just say a little bit about your research and what it is that you're interested in?
It's using all the tricks from seismology to space-based observations to see what's happening now to the Earth. So how you actually make things like mountains and basins and what shapes the land and the continents, which is what all geologists have always been interested in. But what I do is use the range of modern technological tricks to allow us to look at what's happening now, rather than try and understand, work out how things got into such a dreadful mess in the past.
And it sounded from your talk like there's quite a lot of new technology at the moment for monitoring the Earth. I mean, how has that changed? Is that quite a
recent development? We have a huge amount of new information, both land-based, for example, seismology, which has become more and more sophisticated, more and more instruments, much more of a global collaboration than it used to be. So there's a huge amount of extra information there with better instruments recording higher quality information. But also we have a lot of information from space. In particular, I was using GPS measurements, and GPS is the system which is basically used for navigation, but which, if used in the way we use it, actually measures distances between points extremely accurately. And so if you measure these points several times, you see how the distance changes, and we can do that and monitor things that grow at the rate your fingernails do.
And this presumably is very useful for monitoring imminent earthquakes and events on the human scale.
You can monitor strain building up. So you can map, what you can see is things changing shape in response to forces. What's much harder is to tell you, is to see or to forecast when they will break. So it's like if you have a ruler and bend it, you can watch the bending of the ruler, but actually saying when it's going to break precisely is a much harder thing to do.
So perhaps as a sort of academic exercise, it's an interesting area of research, but in terms of where we should tunnel resources, then in terms of saving lives, it's not necessarily a priority prediction.
That's my view. Not everyone would agree, absolutely. Yeah. But it's more than an interesting academic exercise. Of course, it would be interesting to know if you could do that. But it's not a priority, in my view, and nor has it shown any sign of progress in the last 30 or 40 years. It's not that people haven't tried. Clever people have tried. Vast amounts of resources have gone into that effort, but to be frank, it's not got anywhere. Whereas the engineers, the architects have certainly achieved a huge amount. They have gone somewhere. And the connection between them and the scientific understanding is really important, so that they can't do anything unless the scientists can actually tell them what they're up against. And at that level, things have improved dramatically.
So this is quite an interesting area of sort of intersection between the scientists and engineers and all sorts of different...
I think the message from the big earthquakes recently in Japan and Chile and in New Zealand are that at some level that works. That communication is very important, but the scientific understanding is there to reduce the hazard dramatically, I think.
In terms of the future and earthquake mitigation, there's a sort of strange mixture of things going on because we're getting better at predicting and understanding, well, not predicting, but mitigating. But at the same time, populations are growing in these big centres. Which way do you think that's likely to go in terms of the impact of
major events? Well, what scares a lot of us seismologists is the huge growth in urban populations in places which have been destroyed by earthquakes in the past. But the most vulnerable places are actually in the interiors of continents, which is where most people live. There are huge cities, they've been destroyed in the past, but the earthquakes don't happen as frequently as they do on the plate numbers, and therefore there's less of a knowledge passed on from one generation to the other, and less of an awareness, and there's a big job to actually simply identify where all the faults are. So it's partly because the earthquakes happen less frequently and repeat less often on the same faults, but there are many, many more faults. The plate boundaries are essentially a single fault, so you know what's going to happen. You may get some of the details wrong, as in Japan, but there's no surprise as to what actually is the geological process that's going on. And the continents have plenty of surprises, and we don't know where most of the faults are, I'm sure. And so you have to be creative. You have to look for signs in the landscape or in the young geology, which tells you there are active processes going on.
If there are these areas which are sort of known or maybe not well known enough for being danger zones, why is it then that people seem to populate around them? Is there an advantage to living in
a lot of the reason habitations are where they are in the interior of the continents are actually geological reasons. They are where the water supply is, or they control strategic trade routes. They are on the edges of mountains which skirt deserts, or on the edges of high mountain plateaus. There are lots of places you can't live on continents. You can't live in the middle of a salt desert. You can't really live on an icy plateau. You live around the edge. And the edges are edges because that's where the faults are moving in earthquakes. So there's a tendency to gravitate towards the places that are dangerous. Because those are the places which make life possible in these areas. You have to live where there's water. And if the water's there because there's a fault leaking out springs at the surface, that's where you live. And that's fine until the fault moves and kills you. But until that point, it's fine.
So it's a sort of trade-off in terms of risk then?
Very much. It's the relation between the people and the geology in the continents which makes these places vulnerable.
Are there any big areas of risk that you as researchers are really concerned about?
Yes. The places we're very worried about are the big cities in poor, underdeveloped countries in Asia, essentially, really. I mean, to some extent on land in other countries and I would say in places which are not on plate boundaries. So even Haiti, which is an island, is not really on a recognisable plate boundary. The fault which moved is one of lots of faults over quite a big region. And those places are difficult to deal with, and they're very vulnerable people. And when the big earthquake happens, you lose hundreds of thousands of people. So yes, those are the places everyone's worried about.
And the things that can be done there, presumably, are quite a complex mixture of economic and social factors as well.
It is very hard to know what to do. But they are vulnerable because of a combination of poverty, ignorance, corruption as well. And it's hard to separate out those three things. They all merge together to make a very, very difficult trap to get out of one way or another.
Yeah. So in terms of the future and developing sort of warning systems for these events and things, are there still lessons to be learned?
Yes, certainly. And there was the big surprise in Japan was how much movement there was in the fault very close to the trench. That's what anyone expected. We don't know why.
What sort of scale did those movement in terms of displacement of land?
The slip on the fault near the trench was 50 metres in one go, so that's two standard swimming pool lengths. It's a vast amount of slip. It's the biggest slip ever noticed in a single earthquake. And it was roughly twice as much as anyone was expecting. Hmm. So quite why that should be is not understood. It's probably something to do with the nature of the fault, the nature of the friction on the fault. So the Japanese are intending to drill a hole through it at a depth of several kilometres to look at its properties, but that single experiment will cost a few hundred million dollars. And these are not easily investigated, these things.
James Jackson is Professor of Earth Sciences at the University of Cambridge and our January Shell Lecturer. Carbon capture and storage has been suggested by many countries as a way to limit carbon emissions. Instead of being pumped into the atmosphere, the carbon produced by power stations and petrochemical companies could be captured, transported and stored underground. But how safe is it? And is it really the answer to our climate problems? Mike Stevenson explains. People have this image, I think, of sort of getting a lump of carbon and burying it, and presumably it's a bit more complicated than that. Where are we actually putting all this CO2?
Disposal of CO2 has been done in at least three places successfully. For example, in Sleipner, which is in the Norwegian sector of the North Sea, there's more than 10 million tonnes in the rock down below the Sleipner platform. Sandstone, some kinds of limestones, even shale, have a certain amount of space in them because, you know, these rocks aren't 100% dense. And in a sandstone, for example, you've got spaces between the rock particles. Yeah. And in normal circumstances, that's filled with water, usually saline water. If you're lucky, it might have natural gas or oil in it, but generally it's filled with saline water. And putting CO2 in it means shifting that water out of the way.
But it's not just sort of an empty space waiting
be filled? No, it's not empty. We're not talking about putting CO2 in caves or tunnels or anything like that. We're talking about putting it into pore space.
How safe is it down there? Presumably a lot of modelling's been done to make sure of that.
Generally, the seismic monitoring that's been going on seems to show that CO2 moves in the way that we would model it. So it gives us a lot of confidence
I mean, is there a sort of sense in which presumably one day in the distant future it probably will all start to leak through? And
no, because these seals are so impermeable that, you know, it would take a huge amount of time. The CO2 will eventually become more dense than the formation water itself, so start to descend. And secondly, yeah, it will also probably mineralise. So most geologists see the most difficult part at the beginning. The longer time that elapses, the safer it becomes.
So we're already doing this on a pretty big scale then?
Well, not big enough to make a difference, because, you know, we have a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere and there are a lot of power stations. People say that a power station of the size of Ratcliffe, a middle-sized power station, comes online every week in China.
Wow.
And I think most countries in the world have got a very open mind as far as CCS is concerned, because what it allows countries to do is to continue generating electricity, but at the same time not fill the atmosphere full of CO2. Nobody's saying that CCS will go forever. The idea is to use it as a bridging technology, so until renewables can take the strain, because they can't really do it at the moment.
That was going to be my next question, really. Yeah. It's not seen as a sort of the answer to the CO2 problem.
No,
so
I think
much
that would be
it's
crazy. I think that would be crazy to do it forever, because it is complicated and it is expensive. I think what we have to do is kind of wean ourselves off this power-hungry diet, if you like. Renewables is one thing, but also just saving energy, making sure that we don't use so much energy. And, you know, some areas of CO2 abatement, like transport, are much more difficult to deal with. And things like CO2 abatement on air transport are really difficult, because nobody's going to fly in an electrically powered plane. And I certainly I'm not going to do that.
So I suppose the counter-argument would be, is this in a way kind of putting off the inevitable and maybe prolonging the life of this sort of electricity-hungry world we live in? Maybe
yeah,
we shouldn't.
It's an interesting idea. One Greenpeace person that I spoke to said that CCS is a bit like liposuction on a very fat person. What it does is it allows them to continue in this, you know, rather silly way, and you know, artificially allows them to live like that. I don't think that's the best way of looking at it, because we have such a strong commitment to coal in the world. If developing countries that, you know, want to have a powerful economy, you know, want to generate electricity, they'll look straight to coal if they have a lot of it. And so, you know, this is a problem. The only way you can deal with that is by having CCS on these big coal power stations.
Is this going to be something that's quite a hard sell for the public? Because it seems something where the benefits of it aren't very visual unless you think in a climate-orientated way.
I think it is a hard sell, because it's going to cost something, and it's not as if independently or individually somebody will benefit, particularly if you live in an area where CO2 pipeline is going past your house. I mean, there's no reason to support it, absolutely no reason at all. My feeling is that this is primarily about climate abatement, and I hope I'm not being too idealistic here, but the reason we're contemplating this idea is to clean the atmosphere up. I think if people understand that, I think it's an easier thing to discuss.
I suppose you run into problems when you come across people who don't believe the atmosphere needs cleaning up, but
yeah,
presumably there isn't much choice. Your electricity bill goes up.
Yeah,
and it's
as I say, well, I think most people are either convinced that there is a relationship between higher CO2 and climate change and that the Earth is warming, or they are cautious enough. It's a cautionary principle thing that, look, okay, we're not absolutely sure, but let's do something about it just in case.
And you mentioned as well the sort of interesting kind of circularity of the fact that all this CO2 came from these carboniferous forests that were sort of CO2 storage mechanisms in themselves. That even CO2 sequestration could actually go too far the other way and sort of cool the atmosphere.
Yeah, well, that's a kind
I don't know
of,
if that was a serious suggestion.
Kind of
on your
geological
part.
Joke there, but there is. It's true that the Industrial Revolution was at first powered by carboniferous coal. You know, there is an interesting idea that coal could have been a strong enough sequesterer, or coal forests might have been good enough to suck out enough CO2 to make a difference to the atmosphere. So there are other ways that you can make an ice age, but you can't deny there was a massive great ice age in the Permacarboniferous. It was, you know, one of the longest and one of the deepest that the Earth suffered.
But you don't think we're going to go quite that far ourselves?
I wish we'd, you know, I wish
if
we
only
were in that area that we could do that. Getting our CO2 emissions down to levels where they're manageable would be difficult enough.
So it seems like it's fairly safe to do and not too technologically difficult to do. So presumably there's a sort of sense of urgency to this now that
there is
a
sense
of
urgency. And the government is very, very serious about this. You know, our government, to give it real credit, it's really taken this the bull by the horns, and there's loads of political will here to do it. And it's the third plank of, you know, the energy policy in this country. DEC, the Department of Energy and Climate Change, has formed OCS, which is the Office for Carbon Capture and Storage. So, you know, I don't doubt that we have commitment here. Not all countries in the world are as committed as us, but I think we see an opportunity.
Mike Stevenson is Head of Energy Science at the British Geological Survey. You can view his Shell lecture, along with all talks in the series, on the Geological Society website.